This is News and Notes. I'm Ed Gordon. On today's roundtable, was the Katrina warning overlooked? And the crisis in Darfur spills into neighboring countries. Joining us today to discuss these topics and more from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C., economist and author Julianne Malveau, president and CEO of Last Word Productions. Bob Meadows, writer of People magazine, joins us from our New York bureau. And Eric Deggans, media critic for the St. Petersburg Times, is at the Poynter Institute in St. Petersburg, Florida. All right, folks, thanks for joining us. We want to talk about what they knew and when they knew it. That seems to be the favorite question of the White House nowadays. A video obtained by Associated Press and released a confidential government memo of a meeting, a briefing that was going on for the president, really shines a light, somewhat different light, if you will, on Michael Brown. Maybe what he was doing in terms of defending himself was right. He suggested to the president, this is a quote, "My gut tells me this is a bad one and a big one," end quote. That is Michael Brown, a top hurricane expert, voiced, quote, "grave concerns," end quote, about the breach of the levees. And suggested that they may not be ready. Michael Brown again, quote, "I'm concerned about their ability to respond, there being disaster teams, to a catastrophe within a catastrophe," end quote. Let me play you something. 4 days after Katrina hit, this is the president on Good Morning America.
There is frustration, but I want people to know there's a lot of help coming. I don't think anybody anticipated the breach of the levees.
That's the president suggesting that no one anticipated, yet it seems very clear based on this videotape and some other affidavits that have been released that the president was engaged and did talk about the levees not being able to hold, Julianne Malveau.
You know, Ed, the breach of the levees had been anticipated, frankly, for almost a decade. The Army Corps of Engineers had been asking for more money. There was evidence that they could not withstand a Category 5, that a Category 4 or 3 would put the city in significant danger. The fact that they had this briefing a day before and that the president talked 4 days after is immaterial when you look at the long arc of neglect of those levees. This was a federal government project. So all the people who want to throw mud at Ray Nagin, throw mud at Catherine Blanco, the governor of Louisiana, really have to look at the neglect that set the situation up. Furthermore, when the president, 4 days later, as you point out on GMA, a Good Morning America says that help is on the way, help didn't come for another day or so. And there are those 6 months after the hurricane hit who would argue that help still hasn't come from them. People are being evicted in Houston and Dallas and other places. As of this week, there are tens of thousands of people who have nowhere to go. You have trailers with no one in them. The fact is that this is a hurricane-inspired coup, because now they're going to have elections on April 22nd, and those elections are going to be elections that basically wipe out years of Reconstruction activity. And so this videotaped information is useful information, but it simply confirms what we've known all along.
Eric Deggans, it does put a different light slightly on Michael Brown, not trying to resurrect him or absolve him from any of the problems and issues that came about. But he did go on to say during this briefing to the president, as well as Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff, that he, Brown, feared that there weren't enough disaster teams to help evacuate at the Superdome.
It makes me sort of question where this video came from. The Associated Press got it exclusively and featured it in a new video service that it has. It distributes video to member stations and websites. And they also had 7 days of transcripts of briefings where the president was also informed, and Michael Chertoff, the head of Homeland Security, was informed about some of the risks regarding the levees and the hurricane. But it makes me wonder, where did this information come from? Because it makes Michael Brown look awful good. And we've seen this week and in previous weeks that Michael Brown is on a sort of rehabilitation tour of sorts. He's doing a lot of press, and he's trying to convince the world that he's been made a scapegoat for Hurricane Katrina. And this video speaks directly to that, which makes me immediately suspicious. And as Julianne pointed out, the risks of the levees have been known for a long time, although they breached, which is different than what people thought would happen. People thought they would be overtopped, and that's what was talked about during this briefing that's in the video.
Bob Meadows, people want to point fingers, they want to find blame, but the reality is that it seems in all corners, and this is what we've been talking about really since Hurricane Katrina hit land, that all corners failed.
That's the thing we've been seeing from the reports issued by the House, by the Senate, by the White House. Everybody has been pointed at, everybody's being blamed for these failings of Hurricane Katrina. That's exactly correct. One of the things that this does, though, is this video is almost sort of like the Rodney King video. You know, you hear about black people getting beaten, but then you finally see it happening by police, and it makes it much more immediate to you. You heard about President Bush just kind of chilling in Texas, but here you see him on this video sitting there being briefed in his short-sleeved shirt in Texas, not asking a single question of his advisors, and then at the end finally saying, "We are fully prepared." Video will always come back to haunt you.
Now, let me suggest this. The White House has released statements and sent the spin doctors out suggesting that we should not take and put too much credence in one videotape that the president was being briefed time and time and time again, Julianne Malvo.
No, we shouldn't put too much credence in one videotape. We have a body of information. And we have, you know, the Republican-only inquiry that points a lot of fingers at the White House, at everybody else. I mean, the spin doctors need to get respun. You know, they need to retool themselves, because certainly none of us is foolish enough, nor is any member of the public, to simply look at this video and say that's the beginning and the end. But we can look at the history. We can look at the people who are still there. That's the issue, Ed. All of this would be immaterial if indeed we would do for New Orleans what we did for New York. If we would decide that we were going to restore that place, restore those people, give them the right of return. But the fact is that we're still fiddling while New Orleans is still underwater, while the Ninth Ward still has not been re-inhabited, while insurance companies are playing with people's lives. So, no, I'm not going to put any credence on the video. I'm going to put credence on what's happening in New Orleans right now, and not the benign, but the malignant neglect of our government. Can't even say it. It's so bad.
Now, one thing I would point out real quickly, I was in New Orleans about 3 weeks ago and spent some time there, and there is failure all over the place. I mean, half the streetlights don't work. There is enough blame still to go around. They don't even know what the footprint of the city is going to be as they go to rebuild it. Local and state and federal officials can't agree. And we've had this sort of paralyzing bureaucracy for months now, and it makes no sense.
Lest we be fooled by the pictures we saw during Mardi Gras. Once you step outside of that business district into residential areas, it is still a mess, and still people reeling in trying to get their lives back together. We just heard from Andy Young. I asked him about the situation in Darfur. As we know, Ambassador Young is a well-known globetrotter and certainly understands the intricate situations in many hotspots. In terms of Darfur, we see the chaos growing. Arab gunmen from Darfur have pushed across and entered Chad, stealing cattle, burning crops, killing many who are resisting. There's been a growing conflict between these countries for years and years. Here's the real question, Bob Meadows, not necessarily about the continuing crisis in the Darfur region. We've talked about that enough. Mm-hmm. Here's the $64,000 question. Does America have to become involved?
Boy, you know, the Bush administration has labeled this a genocide, so you know it must be a bad situation over there. The UN wants to do some things. They want to send in more troops. I know that the president of Sudan has said, you know, Darfur will be a graveyard if non-Africans come in there, because they don't want to have an occupation. This is the type of situation, though, that I think the U.S. has to keep up this type of pressure on the U.N. to act. I don't think the United States should act alone, but I think that they have to keep up the pressure on the U.N. to go in and at least get the African Union that has the security right now. We need to bolster them. That's what really needs to happen, so that they can protect these people.
Eric Deggans, I almost asked that question, almost, I underline, rhetorically, because if you look at America, if you look at the United Nations, it's hard-pressed to assume that they would be able to deploy any more troops that would be viable in trying to stop any type of violence, add a resistance to any region, because both of these entities, militarily and otherwise, are stretched very, very thin.
I think we see twin tragedies here. The first is the continuing result of our foray into Iraq. We are so depleted militarily that even if we wanted to provide substantial troops to aid in Darfur, we'd be hard-pressed to find them. And we've also set this pattern in motion where Muslim countries and Muslim activists are very wary of American troops coming into any region and trying to establish the peace. There's been fears about al-Qaeda moving into Darfur and the Sudan if America and Western nations get more involved in sending troops there. The other tragedy we have here is the incredible bureaucracy of the UN. They have been so slow to act. They've known this is a genocide for years. They have just now reached the point where they are considering some kind of sanctions against the Sudan, and they still haven't agreed on whether or how they will send in peacekeeping troops, which are desperately needed by the AU.
So, Julianne Malveau, what do we see? It's almost as though you sit by, as we have too frequently, and of late many of us have learned of it, and watch this kind of genocide on the continent. Upwards to 200,000 Sudanese have already fled for safety, and now we're looking at those who live in Chad agonizing over whether or not they're going to be able to walk outside and live their lives as they know it.
You know, Ed, we can't even begin to state the magnitude of this. Someone says if we go in or if the UN goes in, it'll be a graveyard. It's a graveyard already. The implications combined with the deaths, the rapes, the torture, the looting, combining that with the displacement, we're talking about millions of lives. And we have known about this. The public has known about this for at least the past 2 years. It's been going on for nearly a decade. The United Nations needs to step in. They need to move, and the United States needs to keep up pressure. But I think more, this is a world issue, and the world has all too often, we look back to Rwanda, turned its back on Africa. To say that if this were happening anywhere else in the world, Ed, it would be unacceptable. But that it happens here, we can sit around and have debate, is it genocide or not genocide? You know, who should go there? We've been basically remiss, and there are very few lobbies, even in the United States, when groups like Africa Action and TransAfrica have stepped up. But there have not been many who have stepped up and said, this is an important issue. And so we're really all remiss here.
Turning our attention to a side issue to all of this, in fact, and that is if, in fact, troops were to enter yet another war zone, how would they hold up? Questionnaires filled out after troop deployment are finding that 1 in 3 soldiers and Marines who have served in Iraq later seek mental health services. We are seeing, Eric Deggans, a growing number of returning veterans needing hospitalization or psychiatric care.
I don't think that's a surprise. I mean, considering the conditions in Iraq, where the insurgency can spring these deadly attacks without warning anywhere, it makes sense that we would have troops who would come back and be traumatized. And I think we're in an environment now where people are more likely to seek mental help than maybe they would have been 30 or 40 years ago, which is really the last time our American troops have faced such a deadly conflict. So, you know, it makes perfect sense to me. And it's another one of these hidden costs of the war that, you know, certain presidential administrations would prefer we not consider.
What we don't see, Julianne Malveau, is the idea of the ongoing issue of these men and women who return. Often you think, well, they seek psychiatric help and they get better and they move on with their lives. But unfortunately, many of them do not.
You know, this is a different kind of war, Ed. One of the things that we've been reading about over the past year are the number of people who come back maimed, wounded, with the loss of a limb or something like that. The numbers are much higher. Our medical technology makes it easier to save people who might have died in the past. And so you have people who will have long-term wounds and long-term adjustment effects, and the people around them. In addition, the people who serve with them, who saw somebody's arm get shot off or, you know, their face crushed in, they have the recurring nightmares and as well. The other thing about this war that's different is you don't really have a front line as you did in some place like Vietnam. You have all this stuff dispersed all over the place, so someone who's simply patrolling a street has as much chance of being in harm's way as someone who is on a front line. So it's a much more dispersed kind of thing. And I think the 1 in 3 number, frankly, is low. And I think that there's no way we can begin to estimate what the long-term social costs of this war will be in terms of people's mental health.
this really identified after the Vietnam War, Bob Meadows, but we are seeing many of these soldiers come back with a post-traumatic stress disorder, and that is something that often stays with them until they pass away.
That's one of the reasons why this program was instituted, why the military instituted this mental health screening program, because after the Vietnam War, actually it was Vietnam veterans who said, you know, really lobbied for post-traumatic stress disorder to be recognized. Many soldiers, because it's a macho organization, many soldiers are reluctant to seek treatment. But like somebody said, this is we're now in a society where perhaps seeking treatment is more acceptable than it used to be. But one thing that might put a halt to all this is that although Bush's budget has a 6% increase in spending for the Department of Veterans Administration's affairs, it hinges on $1 billion in cuts in other programs. So veterans are actually like, you know, we still don't have enough money to handle all these soldiers who are going to come back with all these difficulties.
And Julianne Malveaux, we forget the ripple effect. This not only affects the individual, but their families, because oftentimes you do not come back to the same job. You're not the same person you were, and therefore do not present yourself in a way that employees might see you as beneficial.
Absolutely. And I think, again, you know, we're seeing right now just the tip of the iceberg. We have, you know, the military has begun to deal with families, what happens with spouses, what happens with relationships, what happens with children, and again, how people will reintegrate themselves into society. You have stories of the Post and the Times have been doing series of, you know, guys who are sleeping with their guns or who cannot hear anything startling without, you know, not getting a good night's sleep. And so when we freely go into war, we underestimate what the human costs are. And our history of a macho culture has allowed us to sweep it under the rug in the past. And let's not forget also that there are women who are also in this war, women who have, you know, tremendous implications as well. We talk about the macho culture, but we forget about the fact that perhaps 15% of our enlisted troops are women.
In fact, that is the case. And letters not sent to me, I did say the men and women at war. Thank you, Julianne Malveaux, though, for echoing that. Julianne Malveaux, Bob Meadows, and Eric Deggans, I thank you very much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.